Welcome to BridgeEd, the podcast brought to you by The Bridge here at Wellington College, where we'll be joined by a series of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in the education sector.
So, Kevin House, I'm really happy that you're here with us again today. I always look forward to our conversations. And this one in particular, because we have an audience. And I'd really like to let other people know your thoughts about education, because I always find them to be really inspiring and challenging and thought-provoking.
So, that's very kind of you.
Let's start with your title. So you work for Education in Motion and you are Education Futures Architect. And I think that's a fascinating title. And I'd love to hear you explain what it means or how you see it.
Okay, I'll have a go. I'll probably begin by describing how it came about. So I've had the luxury in working with what was Dulwich College International and then became Education in Motion. I've been with the group for 7 years. Excuse me. And the founder, Fraser White, has always been very interested in innovation in education and really gave me free rein to play in that space, have time to research in that space, explore. And at one point he said, why don't we try and create a kind of high school that in the international private sector at least had not been seen before. Kind of a 2.0, I suppose, high tech high, that kind of project based. We developed a curriculum framework for it and I headed up that project. We called it provocation based learning. It had dynamic and transformative literacies as the components, as opposed to disciplinary curricula. And in as we were looking to find sites and look at the development of the school, he said, well, we need to repurpose your kind of what your job description is. Before that, I was the director for the Institute for Learning and Research, not a dissimilar role or roles to the ones that you've held, Karen. So, and I was like, oh, I'm just really tired of director of this and director of that. And it's like, why don't we just play around? And the person, Carly, who I was working with on the project, who's a really creative thinker, said, well, we're playing around with education futures. So why don't we say you're an education futures architect? And we're like, that's an odd title. And one thing it will do is whenever you say that, it inevitably opens the space for a dialogue and a conversation, as it has today. So that was probably about 5 years ago. And then one reason or another, COVID happened, the school, we didn't land the school, but a lot of the, really the R&D, the research and development that we did in developing the idea for that concept fed into a lot of work that we did later with myself. I was happy to have the opportunity for us to become one of the early funders for Raya Bichari's School of Humanity, which is an online hybrid model of high school. And we worked together on their human literacies curriculum. And then around that time, also EIM acquired the Green School in Bali and the relationships with Green School South Africa and Green School New Zealand. And I worked with them to recreate their curriculum around what became the Green Literacies, which was, I suppose, in simple terms, a more of an inquiry-based approach. You look at conceptual, transdisciplinary areas of design of curriculum, and you bring into it the disciplinary expertise and as and when it was needed in the context. And so that's kind of really how I became known as the architect. And it's been a fun journey. And people still ask me, what does it mean? But that's kind of how we got there.
Well, the idea of contributing to an architecture for the future is a pretty positive one, I think, very appealing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I was very, very blessed, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have the time to explore and be given the trust to explore. And then having, as I said, the amazing opportunities to work with Green School. And it led me on a path that really did a number of things, but probably four or five years ago in that work, starting to explore more systems thinking methodologies, worked with Peter Senge on compassionate systems, Nora Bateson and the Warm Data, Dave Snowden's work. And latterly, I worked closely with a chap called Luke Roberts, who does a lot of systems work with in institutional practices here in the UK with hospitals, prisons, and education, which are big systems environments. And he and I are working on a leadership program at the moment we have for our senior leaders called Aspire, where we're trying to bring systemic methodologies into thinking about leadership. And the, one of the reasons I got really, really interested in that is because for me, I think a lot of what we do, particularly in big institutional environments like education, is that we really, probably going back to the Greeks, but the journey from the Greeks, particularly to the Enlightenment and the acceleration after the Enlightenment, and it dovetails with the colonial project and capitalism, I suppose, was really being systematic as opposed to systemic. So in other words, what I mean by that is taking big problems and breaking them down into their component parts, the empirical method, the taxonomies, if you like, the nano expertise that you get at tertiary level, where you become an expert in a very, very tiny bit of a discipline. We're very, very good at that, and we've worked at that, and we've built education systems around that. But I would say in the polycrisis, or what some call the metacrisis, these are big, complex systems. And they're big, complex systems challenges. And actually, in education, I think we've built a very, very rigorous, disciplinary, systematic approach to understanding the world and ourselves in that world. But it's at the detriment of more intuitive ways of knowing and more systemic ways of knowing. And that journey through systems took me toward looking at indigenous knowledge systems, where I think there, in that pre-Greco environment, which many of the indigenous cultures still have, those that are left after the colonial project, as it were, still have a far more balanced approach to us as beings within beings on a living planet. And for that, in me, for me particularly in late life, that really resonates in everything that I see, is that if in education we become more systemic rather than more systematic, and it's not to say systematic is bad, if you think of it more as a yin-yang construct, we need systemic awareness and sensibility as much as we need systematic awareness and sensibility. And so it's how do we in the education space design institutions, learning, explorations that allow students to make sense of the world that balances both systemic and systematic. So for me, that's become a real driver in my thinking and where I try and spend most of my time in my happy place, as it were, in the work that I do.
There's something about what you're saying that really resonates with me, and it has to do with the ways in which we could, as educators or as thinkers or as just your average human being, open ourselves up to perhaps alternative sources of knowledge than ones that we would consider on a daily basis. And that it's important, for me, I think it's important that we challenge hierarchies of knowledge. As you were speaking, there was a word I was sort of expecting to hear, because I have heard of it in the past, and that is about regenerative education. And is that a word that you are using less now, or is it one that you see as inherent in systems thinking?
It's a really good point. And I was expecting you to say the F word.
Which one?
Flourishing, but you went for the R word instead. Look, I think one of the things I'll put out, and I'll be really candid about it, from my perspective, very, very strong and well-established institutional structures are incredibly efficient at appropriation. So they take concepts, they appropriate them, but they don't actually change. And I think if you look at those two terms that I just mentioned, flourishing and regenerative, in the educational world, they're already well underway to being appropriated as a kind of, in a very simplistic way, as a kind of rebrand for not changing much in the system. With the work I was doing with Green School 4 years ago, we were really looking quite deeply at what would a narrative for regenerative education be. We were very mindful that as we started to socialize the term a lot, that term would become appropriated in different contexts in education, and you're seeing regenerative economics and various other disciplinary practices, which are a step in the right direction. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that I feel that we've got any, as you'd call it, IP around it. I think regenerative means how can you create environments where you acknowledge and possibly even prioritize emergence as opposed to measurement. And so what I mean by that is that all systems, if you look at all systems, all living systems, balance two things. They balance emergence and they balance entropy. And I think one of the things we need to be aware of in us as individual selves is that we're always a process of entropy and emergence. We're becoming something new as much as we're dying. And, you know, our cells, replication, you know, a very, very nano level, but a very grand scale, I think our systems are the same as well. But we tend not to want to feel comfortable with the ambiguities and the anxieties created by emergence, because we love strategic plans, visions, five-year plans, and particularly in the West. And my time in China, I think, informed me of a different way of seeing many years ago, in that China works to 50, 100-year plans. You know, it's a culture that can trace itself back, that one culture, for 4,000 years. And in the West, we lose sight of that, and we see aspects of Chinese culture through the eyes of the Western paradigm, and not necessarily always with a sense of fairness, particularly in the current geopolitics. But when you look at very, very old cultures like that, and then for me, when you look at indigenous cultures where there are thinkers and people in those cultures trying to capture and communicate those cultures to us, you realize these are much, much older things. And what they are always aware of is the regenerative component, the emergent component of what they are, and the entropy, the things that have to give way for the new to emerge. And for me, regenerative education is about that with young people. If you take it down to a young person, how does an educator creates space in a landscape dominated by outcomes and measurement, and, you know, many of the things that Gert Biester and others would offer critiques to. How, in that kind of environment and the institutional practices that inform that, how do you create the space for the emergence of the young people in your care that you work with, and for, in that dynamic relationship between them, the things that will emerge within you as an educator? Mm-hmm. And how do we embrace that and recognize that and acknowledge that? And I think that's a really, really important part of what, for me, regenerative education means. It's about how do we get that balance right, about it being rather than it being a destination, and rather than even being a journey, because I think even, you know, a lot of the lexicon in education is about it being a learning journey. That again implies that you're going to be in a certain point in time at some point. Whereas I think for me, regenerative in the educational context is more of a nomadic, it's a more of a cyclical thing. We go through cycles of learning where we emerge from that ready for new curiosity, new challenges, and that's it's a cyclical journey. It's a more nomadic thing. And I think people like Rosie Brodotti's work around nomadic subjects, and that I remember many, many years ago looking at her stuff in that kind of postmodern, post-structural space, and she's still doing great work in that space now about the nomadic subjects. And that hers was around gender fluidity and various other aspects of self and selfhood. But I think for me, regenerative and systems and Indigenous knowledge systems is really, if you look at it, is really, really similar to a lot of the stuff that was appropriated in the sort of post-structural, post-modern French philosophy. And I was amazed recently when I really got into the work of people like Gregory Bateson. I was reading this and going, well, this is Deleuze and Guattari, mm-hmm. but he was doing it in the 1930s, 1940s with Margaret Mead and the anthropological work and the cross-disciplinary work they were doing. And then when I started looking at Indigenous knowledge, you see that there are Indigenous scholars and Indigenous thinkers who are already in this space. And it's almost a forgotten landscape for us in the West in terms of our knowledge because of that very successful journey we've been on from probably late Grecian society, really, where we started to create various things that Foucault and others have talked about, where we started to objectify the self and various other things started taking place. We drifted a long, long way from what I'm starting to think of now as the intuitive knowing of what it is to be human. Intellectually, we are incredibly fluent. But intuitively, I think in the West, we're incredibly naive because we do not prioritize that. And I'm beginning to see how that plays into another area of naivety in Western thought for me and education is ethics and morality. Because again, that plays in the space between the intellectual and the intuitive. And that's kind of where a lot of my thinking's sort of occupied now.
Well, I imagine that anybody who's listening to this is feeling like I am, that there's just so much in what you're saying that is powerful and that is probably inarguable and challenging to think about in terms of, you know, what does it mean for us in our daily lives as educators and in schools? And there's one thing that came to mind when you were speaking is the danger. You used the word appropriation and the appropriation of concepts or terms to the point whereby they become meaningless. So you said branding, and there is the sort of the market element to what we're doing. But I'm often disturbed by the ways in which we tend to pick up terms and the ones that we think will resonate. But we are no longer dealing with the substance behind them. You know, what are these concepts? And how can we think about concretely changing systems that are deeply embedded in philosophical, historical, material past? And then there's something else I was thinking about when you spoke about the teacher in a classroom and the margins. And you know, one of the things that really emerges in some of the sessions that we have in courses through the bridge with Patrick Alexander or with Andreon is the frustration, I think, that many classroom practitioners feel in the fact that there's tremendous pressure, the program, the curriculum, the exams, the time, and a sense that they don't have the agency, the freedom to explore the margins or to seize those moments of emergence in a classroom that are so important. Sometimes that comes with maturity, when you've been in the classroom for a long time. But in the systems that we continue to construct today, we reduce freedom for exploration in ways that I think is really sort of nefast, is not good for us.
No, and you mentioned Patrick, and I know Patrick and I chatted at when I was doing a presentation at a conference 2-3 years ago about this, because I offered a provocation at the time, which was a provocation. I used to be a theory of knowledge teacher in the IB diploma, and it was one of my starters with students, was really, what's the first thing you learn at school? So we'd have an exploration of their memories of early childhood education. And no one ever came up with the answer I was going to offer them. But we'd have some really lovely conversations and explorations, and we'd make the space to do that and get to know one another. But what I was fishing for was, my provocation to them, and I used it in this presentation, the first thing you learn in school is a management of your time and your space, and it's a school timetable. So the very, very first thing a child has to interact with in school is a timetable. I have to be in a certain place at a certain time doing a certain thing. Now that's I would argue that is an Enlightenment industrial construct. And everything, if you think about it, in the education space is dictated by that. And you can add assessment, and you can add examinations and credential capital and so forth. All of that stacks on that initial interaction, which is you will be here at this time and do these things at these times. Now, if you think about that in a broadly human way, we these days, it's almost innate that our lives are dominated by time and space, or rather the regulation of time and space. But of course, that isn't our natural state. Now, as I said before, there is always a trade-off. I'm not suggesting that we stop all the clocks, but there has to be a sense of balance. I think we've probably gone far, far too much in one direction and never really looked at trying to balance. You know, there's various ways you might look at those. And I hesitate to say dualities, because again, that inevitably involves an exclusive dynamic relationship between those two things, whereas I would say it's those two things within a greater thing. So it is a more systemic reality. So time and space exists in the time and space of all living things, not just my time and space and those of the institution. So once you start really saying, well, how do we find more balance between having space and time to explore and share the value of that exploration together without any inclination of where it's going? And how do we also pay some heed to the need to do certain things? And I think if we just prioritize the latter of those, I think that's why we're seeing what's been called for many years a well-being and now flourishing crisis, is that really every interaction we have in the educational space, but in our social space, our private spaces now with technologies, most of those are about the regulation and management of your time and space, and now your attention. And most of those have been commercialized, marketized, and they've become a way of creating wealth for very few people. That's I think breaking communities. So I think it all really does interrelate.
Kevin, you've given us so much to think about, and I know I will ponder what you have said for some time, and I look forward to continuing the conversation in our next episode.
Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow, and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn, and you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.